Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by an incredibly interesting individual, Dermot McParland, who's the creative director of the Nederlander Studios in New York. He is a maverick cultural connector who instigates cultural interventions for brands doing things rather than making things, an assembler, a curator, and an event organizer. He's a resolutely proud member of the London Irish diaspora with a background that spans 20 years in publishing, advertising, activism, publicity, and the arts. He's obsessed with ideas and culture, wide and deep, and possesses an uncanny ability to see creative and strategic opportunities for brands within the culture. His work output is idiosyncratic, diverse, and multidisciplinary that includes experience design, activation, content, social, ads, PR, and experiential. His strong international links into the world of contemporary art, fashion, cinema, music, and literature. And finally, his nurtured close links into the nascent startup creative businesses in the world of communications and entertainment. His background prior to being where he is now, he was a junction maker at the mighty Droga 5. Before that, creative director at VCCP Kin. For a while, he then was acting purely as a consultant, but working with some really interesting brands like Sunshine, 180 Amsterdam, Rennie Kelly Campbell Rolf, Y&R, Canongate, All Tomorrow's Parties, Critical Mass, Faber & Faber, Mindshare, Jotta, and Human After All. Before that, he was creative director at the Cake Group. Before that, head of experience at Mother. Before that, he was a founding partner at the mighty PD3, back when Shoreditch was Shoreditch. And before that, he was a publisher at the absolutely immense Big Issue. So, Dermot, hi, and how are you?
Hey, Sean, good morning. Good. I think we met in the PD3 days, correct?
We certainly did, loitering around Hoxton in the 90s. Happy days. And so you should be in New York, but you're not, are you? You're in London, so... What's going on, apart from the obvious?
Well, I guess you can work from anywhere. That's the one thing that we've learned. I am working with a new company based largely out of New York. Really, I should be there for summer most of the time, but I'm in London. But there are people in the team who are in the West Coast, people calling in from Ireland, there's people calling in from Sweden. It's a very international crew, so we just got to do it remotely until it's safe.
Yeah. And so just in terms of, let's say, sort of talking through in real detail what exactly it is that you're up to now, it'd be great, as always, with all these podcasts, just to take a guided tour through your background, because you've had an incredibly interesting and sort of, you know, and creative and culturally vibrant career path. So go on then. So starting from wherever you like, Big Issue, whatever. Yeah. Take us through the windy path to where you are now.
Well, I basically, Sean, hustled my way into advertising without having the benefit or maybe the hindrance of going to ad school. So, you know, I came to London, worked in independent publishing in Camden, and then I met this fascinating character called John Bird. And he had launched this magazine, which I'd had seen around town, called The Big Issue. And it was a monthly, I don't know if you remember the first few issues, really high production values, with art newspaper.
Yeah.
And I'd seen this thing and it was just quite fascinating. So I met John, and I mean, I was completely seduced by him, by his personality and his enthusiasm. But I just kind of got the feeling that this gig ain't really for me. I just also felt that, you know, a business predicated on homeless people being your workforce was probably not going to get very far. He had the support of the Roddicks from the Body Shop, who are great, great people. And we lost Anita Roddick way too early. But anyway, Bird was such a convincing character that he, even though I tried to talk myself out of working at the Big Issue, he basically wouldn't let me leave his office until I basically agreed to join. And I mean, frankly, I had kind of minimal experience, really. And a lot of the people surrounding the whole scene did as well. It was a very maverick operation. There were people who were serious about doing a real magazine. But there were loads of do-gooders and kind of write-on people, and loads of hangers-on. But Bird had this kind of Warholian ability to attract people. You know, he would literally go out to buy some rolling tobacco and come back and he'd have hired a journalist. You know, he was just extraordinary. So the whole thing should never have worked. And it became, you know, it was a social business. People were trying to get their heads around this thing. It's a charity thing. People just buy it to help homeless people, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I got there in 82 and I stayed till 99. So quite a long stint. At the beginning, there were a few issues in and they were hemorrhaging cash, Body Shop cash.
Yep.
So we had to basically try and make the magazine editorially strong and increase the frequency. Anyway, long story, we built the thing up. We made it a weekly. By the mid-90s, you know, we were selling north of 350,000 copies a week. It became a bit of a phenomenon, you know, and it was in the culture. And, you know, they were selling as much as The Guardian sell in a day. So we were kind of a going concern. And then the weird thing happened where people would start coming to us, you know, without being solicited, saying, we want to give you a world exclusive interview. And this happened on a number of occasions. You know, I mean, the Stone Roses, George Michael, various characters like that. So anyway, it was a fascinating and bizarre journey. I mean, I was really young. I was on the board and we were really making it up as we go along. But actually through it, Sean, I got to meet some extraordinary people because it was different. It was a kind of the place where you could ring up anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
You could ring up Damien Hirst and say, Damien, listen, we need guest editors. Do you fancy editing the magazine? And he would come in for a week and do it. Or, you know, we'd get people saying, you really guys need to develop your brand. So, you know, here's two people you should meet, J. Pond Jones and Robert Savile at GGT or John Hegarty at BBA. So I made these early connections who proved to be really important for me going forward. So, I mean, I guess it's called activism now, isn't it? But it wasn't then. It was just a kind of a hustle. That became a thing, and it's now, I think it's in 16 countries. Just celebrated its 25th anniversary. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. On the back of that, I started to think about brands because we started doing partnerships with brands like Levi's and Caterpillar and so on. And then that led me into starting a business with my mate Paul Tully, and we were in near Old Street doing kind of alternative marketing. That's when I met you, Sean. Yeah. And we were basically saying to, I mean, the great thing about running your own business is you can choose your clients. So, you know, you can pick all the brands you like. So you work with Canongate and Faber and Penguin Books and The Guardian and The Observer and Channel 4. And then we had a few other kind of more corporate clients to keep the thing on the road. But that it was quite a bizarre journey. We were doing, I guess these things are all kind of evolving. We were doing what became brand experience. It was for a while, it had that ghastly title, Guerrilla Marketing. Do you remember that?
I certainly do.
Yeah, which sounds so kind of like terrorism. So we did that. And then I knew Robert. And then after I did 7 years or 8 years of running PD3, he got me into Mother, and I was there. And that was probably the greatest work experience of my life because, you know, I only went for a while, you know, for a month or something to help on a project. And I ended up staying like 7.5 years. And, you know, the most of the time at Mother was just extraordinary. It was really exciting and intoxicating. And they seemed to me a lot of the time to have their priorities right in terms of, you know, the creative side of the business coming first, having a good and culture coming second, and then making money coming third. Whereas I think most of the people I've subsequently met seem to have it the other way around. So, so I did that. And then I've been doing my own thing. And I've been working with Droga for a bit, which has been, again, a really great experience. I guess in terms of kind of creativity, John Hegarty has a great way of putting it, which he talks about pure creativity and applied creativity. You know, pure creativity is sheer imagination. You just come up with something from nothing. I'm probably more in the latter, which is applied. I'm a really good collaborator. I like bringing people in, working with them as the kind of adjunct creative team. Putting things together that you wouldn't expect to create something new. That was the kind of stuff that I was doing in Mother. So making films and putting on immersive theatre shows and publishing books and graphic novels and making TV programs and all that kind of, I don't know, all these things. It's called content now, is it? Yeah. So that's a kind of a thumbnail sketch. And I've been trying really to define a kind of a third act and kind of move away from advertising, because as we discussed before, there's just certain things about it that I feel have completely, it's lost its luster. And so I've been trying to, you know, navigate into a new space and have something for myself. And I had this I found this new way of presenting classic music, and I spent a year on it. And the first one was supposed to launch on July the 18th, but obviously we got interrupted somewhat. But that's still going to happen, and it's the most exciting thing I've done because it's with an incredible group of people who made amazing music, and they also have an incredible visual world around them. So that's probably for next year now. In fact, we were supposed to be in London in the summer, and by now we were going to be in Berlin on a tour. So that'll happen in the future. And through doing that, I met these people in New York who started this new studios and were developing music-based stories. It's kind of multi-platform stories, essentially around music. So I spend a lot of my time talking to artists and talking to managers. And it's terribly exciting.
Sounds absolutely fantastic. Very good. And then on that, in terms of the music-based stories, can you talk any more about that at the moment, or is it still totally under wraps?
Well, it's a new company. It hasn't officially launched yet, so I'm sorry, I have to skirt over it. But, I mean, I'm essentially talking to artists. I'm looking for novels. I'm looking for songs that you could turn into TV shows or whatever it may be, and having those conversations all the time. Before doing that, I was doing this kind of junction making thing, which I basically borrowed off somebody who I really regard, Jeremy Deller. I think Deller is amazing because he's just this brilliant collaborator, and he puts things together, you know, in the most unlikely ways, and he always creates something really fresh. So I was trying to take that kind of vernacular of the art world and applied to the kind of commercial creative world. as well as doing, you know, freelance stuff. So you'd get interesting calls, you know, like Jump Studios, great architectural practice would call me. And, you know, they'd say they have this place branding project. Will I come in with them on that? Great. So I found myself in the last few years fielding more calls from production companies and architects. And, you know, I advised the mayor's office on the Euro 2020 cultural program around the football thing. Worked with Art Angel on the Steve McQueen, you know, the kids. With the Year 7 project, which is amazing. So all these kind of interesting things happen. You know, people call you and I won't tell you or your listeners about the absurd call I had yesterday.
Go on.
Which I immediately laughed out loud and hung up. But anyway, generally speaking, I do get interesting calls.
Was it Mike Pence, the vice president? No, Mr. Pence, I will not.
No, it wasn't the Proud Boys.
We're talking earlier on about the vice presidential debate how the mighty Venn Media put out fantastic sort of debate bingo cards where you had a markdown as soon as someone sort of, you know, mentioned anything like the 25th Amendment or Antifa or indeed the hideous Proud Boys or whatever sort of Russia, the Constitution, COVID, etc. On the extraordinary world of that, go on and give us a bit of a viewpoint on that, because obviously when you're back over to New York that'll be very much part of what's going on. So but how do you view the the epic car crash that is American politics? Go on.
Well, I mean, I'm incredibly saddened because I grew up in the west of Ireland, you know, in the 80s and 90s was mass unemployment. America has always been the promised land, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
If we were kids, 80% of our family live in America. So I think for us, America is a really important idea. And what's happening is tragic. You know, you've got rappers who sound like presidents and presidents who sound like rappers. It's just completely bonkers. I just do feel optimistic though, Sean, and I think that the you know, this confluence of these things with kind of extremism, right-wing extremism, environmental catastrophe and the pandemic, you know, this has got to be a moment of significant change. And I think all those kind of Orban and, you know, the Fanta Fuhrer and Johnson, I think these guys are on the way out.
Yeah.
I really do. I really do. You got to hope like that, right?
Yeah. And then just in terms of moving on to, or sort of moving sort of sideways into the world of work and agency land, etc. I mean, you mentioned a while ago, you know, your viewpoint that sort of, you know, ad land has lost its luster, you know, that there are more interesting ways of doing stuff now that creatively link in this context to brands. I mean, at the same time, you know, here we are sort of, you know, autumn 2020. It's been, you know, apart from anything else, just in the context of this, it's been a terrible time for, let's say, college leavers, school leavers looking to get into the world of work. So, you know, if you're advising someone now who had, who was, you know, seeking their first job in, you know, if like in the broadest sense, you know, just agency land, creative brand land, what sort of areas would you be pointing people towards?
Well, I mean, like you, I've got a 17-year-old, you know, I hang with them and listen in on what they're saying. I know the kind of things they're into. You know, like the idea of working in advertising, just, you know, it's like suggesting to them they should become a farmer. You know, they, they're much more interested. I mean, they're slashers, right? They, you know, they're doing loads of things. They're making music and they're printing t-shirts and they're selling, they're entrepreneurs on Depop and, you know, they're they want to work in magazines and, you know, media. I just don't see, and maybe it's the narrow Southeast London set that I see, but I just don't see. I mean, you said to me that you felt that advertising had lost a lot of its confidence. And I think, I think you're right. And I think there was something happened along the way in the last decade where, you know, the balance shifted and everybody thought they knew everything. And people just lost the regard for the, you know, I mean, I didn't go to ad school, but I really respect the craft of great copywriting and great art direction and, you know, making stuff like that. And I just felt that you got clients coming in thinking they know it all. And, you know, I was just looking last night actually at the famous Avis memo with DDB, which I guess dates back to the 50s. You know, the famous one where it basically starts off by saying, Avis will never know more about advertising as DDB, and DDB will never know more about car rental business as Avis. And I just feel like a lot of clients are like steaming into agencies, thinking they know it all, and not really regarding the skill. And then the agencies have, you know, lost their bottle. You know, they're worried about losing the business and all that kind of stuff. And you've just got a bit of a mishmash. And you can see it in the work. It's all really shouty and quite needy, you know. Even post-pandemic, there's a lot of brands doing stuff and it's all like, we hear you, man. We're with you. We know what it's like. And it's just like if somebody came up to you in the street and said that to you, you'd probably knock him out, you know? It's just like, just completely got the wrong tone of voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And then and then you've got the kind of the bigger social upheaval of, you know, civil rights and equality and diversity. And I really can't think of very many brands that have come out of that looking good at all. You know, it's it just seemed to be, you know, like take a James Baldwin quote and put it on your Facebook page or your Instagram feed. I think it's a time for acts, not ads, you know. I think, I mean, early on in March, there were a few things, you know, like Supreme said, you know, we're not going to give any spiel. We're not going to be posting loads of stuff, but we've written a check today for $1 million and we've given it to 3 civil rights charities. End of. And I just thought that's probably as much as you can do right now. Or, you know, it's like Seamus Heaney said, whatever you say, say nothing. So do something rather than preach something. But I think the you know, the original sin is the lack of diversity in agencies, in clients, in leadership teams. You know, you talk to progressive companies now. You know, I was talking to Motown Records, and they're like, "Okay, let's see the makeup of your board. You know, let's see the kind of black representation of creatives in your company." It's like, "Wow, right on! That is exactly the kind of question you should be saying." So, I think it's going to take a long time to get this sorted, and I hope. And the last agency job I had, I made a real effort to bring in young women and to bring in people of color. And it's just loads of people need to do that. And you just need more and more diverse voices. And I know it's terribly cliched, but something has to give here, you know?
How interesting. And then,
you know Cornel West? You know, the American philosopher, academic, he's on TV quite a lot. He's amazing. He's captivating to watch. But I heard him say this amazing thing in relation to Black Lives Matter and all the kids marching and stuff. He said, justice is what love likes when it goes out in public. I just thought,
very good.
That's probably the smartest thing I've heard in the last 6 months.
Wow, very good indeed. Blimey.
Well, you've got to be proud of these kids. And, you know, I've been on loads of marches over the years and I always felt they achieved jack shit, really. You know, like May Day and all kinds of environmental things. And I always felt, unless you have direct action, you're just going to get nowhere fast, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the poll tax thing, I'm 89, that was largely reversed because it descended into mayhem. Sorry, I don't want to come all Malcolm X here, but I do feel a huge sense of pride in the kids. Mm. Right? But I also feel guilt, as anybody with as a parent should, because it's a bit of a shit show we've left them, you know? Like you alluded to, like they can't buy places to live, they can't rent.
Yeah.
You know, the environmental thing, you know, the whole education cock up. You know, I feel guilty, man.
Yeah. And then what about the, just to add to that sort of a sense of a all-encompassing gloom, in terms of the creative world and culture that you sort of exist in, I mean, again, another of the areas that's been absolutely hammered this year has been obviously the world of live entertainment from the point of view of things like everything from theatre to live music to club culture, etc. I mean, in terms of what is happening to the people who are working in those sectors and the and at the moment the lack of ability for the rest of us to take part in, join in, view, listen to, etc., what it is that they are creating or producing, and also the inability of them to actually be allowed to do that, creating, producing, etc. What's your viewpoint on just where this is all going from the point of view of, you know, the, you know, apart from obviously the horrendous personal economic sort of cost for all those people and the implications of it, but in terms of creativity, so one would imagine, so you've got all those deeply frustrated and very, very worried creatives out there. Well, where does that go? You know, what's happening to that creativity when, you know, creativity is being sort of undervalued in the educational sort of sector, and then is almost a sort of, you know, because of COVID, not being allowed to be put out there in the ways that we used to associate the way that it was put out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, COVID-19 is like the Taliban. I mean, it hates the arts. And, you know, we're not helped by a slimy government who rather offhandedly yesterday suggested that people, musicians and so on, should retrain.
Yeah, I know.
Come on. You know, in a civilized European city like Berlin, artists are getting 5,000 euro bursaries to keep themselves going. I think artists get 90 quid a week on universal credit. So, I mean, that says enough. But I think it's I've been impressed. I have a slightly, you said I was being gloomy earlier. Actually, I think I'm being more optimistic because I've actually seen some things which I've been enormously impressed by, which have been direct responses to this pandemic culturally.
Yep.
I saw Jenny Beth from Savages, who I admire enormously. She posted this message on Twitter saying, "Hey, what do you miss about live gigs?" And I said, actually, to be honest with you, I don't miss a lot because terribly corporate venues, massive lines for overpriced drinks, half the people on mobile phones. And she kind of came back to me and said, you know what? You've actually got a bit of a point.
Because
the gig-going experience has been challenging, I think. Yeah. You know, I mean, I go to a lot of gigs, or have done, and I've just, the amount of people talking and filming is just ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, I would say that, you know, the Dave Chappelle 8:46 YouTube film where he basically made a sermon about George Floyd, I thought that was incredibly powerful. I thought Nick Cave's Idiot Prayer was beautiful. In fact, I've been to bad seed shows that I've walked out of, not because of the bad seeds, but because of all the people talking. And I much preferred watching the serenity of him in Ali Pali, beautifully shot by Robbie Ryan. I thought it was one of the best Nick Cave shows I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So I think there have been kind of moments which have been really amazing. You know, Derek Mahan's great poem. And I mean, there are things which have appeared. But I mean, what I feel really bad for is the people who work, not just the musicians, but all the people behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I mean, it's just grim. And it's the lack of kind of empathy for them is extraordinary.
Yeah, that I think, yeah, exactly that, isn't it? It is the sort of empathy bordering on contempt that you seem to sort of get from a lot of the from the governments that just it makes you sort of slightly despair in terms of, do they really not realise what we're going to be what we're going to lose and how it's going to impact these people? It's just incredible.
You know, they're basically an inherently Philistine mob.
Yeah,
and you know that there's no care, no empathy for people who work in opera, dance, theatre, music, film, whatever it may be. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but then maybe we need to find new ways of doing things. And like, you read that Cineworld are going to close all their venues.
Yeah.
And you think, well, actually, is that not a real, did they miss something over the last 6 months with programming? You know, so for instance, the Euros were cancelled, the football. Why didn't they show some of the classic Euros from 76, you know, 84 when the French won?
I would
have gone to see those. Show Euro 96 or you know, like Talking Pictures on TV. I love that channel, which is basically a dad and his daughter who love old British cinema, and they basically do it out of a shed in their garden, and they've built up a massive community. And you just wonder, well, surely some of those picture houses and cine worlds could have been screening a lot of that stuff that there's obviously an audience for it.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
just think it's a little bit glib to say, oh, man, we're screwed because of James Bond didn't come in time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, you can't be staking the whole company on James Bond, can you? So I think it's just about getting creative and programming.
Yeah, yeah. So on the point, by the way, you're just mentioning about things like the epic Nick Cave Idiot Prayer and the Dave Chappelle stuff. I mean, so in terms of things that have been, and I know you just because of those, you have just mentioned them. But again, give us some other things that have been inspiring you over the months of the lockdown, etc. And the sort of as the sort of different waves of the pandemic have come and gone and sort of come again. So yeah, other things that have been. Grabbing your interest.
Sean, do you know Sports Banger, Johnny Banger in Hackney? He's a bootlegger.
I do not.
He's a bootlegger. Worth checking on Twitter. He's great. He's very funny, and he does a kind of an adbustery type thing. But nonetheless, he did a really smart thing in March. Do you remember when Boris Johnson sent that letter, which took 2 weeks to arrive, telling people that there were going to be various restrictions coming? And Johnny Banger invited kids, I think between 8 and 14, to basically tag or deface the letter, because it was, which is actually quite smart because a lot of them are homeschooling. And he got an enormous response of kids uploading their tags on Boris Johnson's letter. And some of them were brilliant and funny. And they were talking about testing and PPE, but it was all very charming. And he's turned it into a kind of an online exhibition. I thought that was great because it had a point, but it was also charming and quite funny. And so that was one of the best things I've seen in the last few months.
Fantastic.
Funny, look, Sports Banger, they're great.
Excellent. Okay, and then what about? I know you can't talk much about it, but the fascinating epic band that you were doing work with, or have been working deeply with, and are having to put slightly on ice. Go on, to put it opaque terms.
there's an incredible group who are probably one of the most iconic groups. And I've had a front row seat with them for over a year now. And it's been nothing if not a privilege. Because they were the kind of, when I was growing up, they were really formative. And we've developed something together, which will happen. And that's been a thrill, because you end up working with and hanging with and meeting people that, you know, you've admired since you started buying The Enemy as a kind of 14-year-old. So that's really exciting. I mean, the other thing I wanted to give a plug to, which is Jerry O'Boyle is a very good friend of mine. I've been helping behind the scenes. We've made a film. Well, Julian Temple's made the film, but we helped get it together. And it's a film about Shane McGowan. It's called Crock of Gold. It just premiered at the San Sebastian Film Festival. Julian Temple did a Q&A with Johnny Depp. And it's going to be at a couple of more festivals, and then it's going to get a theatrical release, but I guess predominantly a streaming release. Julian's great. I mean, he's made, for my money, probably two of the best rock films. The one about Oil City Confidential about Dr. Feelgood, and The Filth and the Fury, the Sex Pistols one. So he made a film about Shane, and it's part of it is a gig that we did in Dublin in 2018, which was Shane's 60th. And it was a tribute on his birthday to his songwriting. And pretty much everybody we asked came and performed. And we had a house group, which was a lot of Elvis Costello's and the Attractions group and some of the
Pogues. Fantastic.
And we had guest singers who sang the songs. And Nick Cave was there, and Bobby Gillespie and Bono and Sinead and a lot of the young Irish groups. And so part of that stuff is going to be in the film as well. So I think that's a really great piece of work. It's called Crock of Gold. You know, McGowan's story is amazing. He's he's kind of Celtic poet. That's basically coming soon.
You mentioned Julian Temple there. I mean, despite the fact that obviously the film sounds absolutely fantastic, so things like Great Rock and Roll, Spindle, How Superb, but proving that nobody gets it right every time, he also did Absolute Beginners, which you liked it.
That's where you and I part company, Sean.
Exactly. I thought one of the most epic books of all time, the Colin McInnes classic, and written like an absolute screenplay, and perhaps it's down to the casting, but didn't see that one. What about just going back to some of the agencies you work with, Dermot? So again, they've been very, very leading edge agencies. Can you just talk a bit about essentially what it was that was different between them in terms of their approach? I know you mentioned a bit of that in terms of the mother sort of the viewpoint on how they sort of went around what they did and all the rest of it in terms of areas of importance. But I mean, I think a lot of people tend to view most agencies as being broadly exactly the same, different name above the door. Everyone's got a weird haircut, and they're all vaguely annoying. Yeah. Talk about just the differences between a Droga 5 and a mother and a cake, etc.
Well, mother was, in a way, it was amazing that I went in and did that, and really, I should have just stopped after doing mother, because it's frankly a bit of a disappointment everywhere else since, because there were moments where it kind of was really great. And a lot of it came to a genuine desire to do what the agency wanted to do and what they felt was the right thing to do, rather than what the client wants to do. So it seems to me very clear as well, and we touched on this earlier, but the kind of creative agency versus collateral marketing communications business. So a lot of agencies, who say they're creative agencies, but really they're just churning out collateral. And, you know, I'm not dissing that, but I think it's probably best to be honest about that. Certainly when I was a mother, they were getting Shane Meadows to make a feature film for Eurostar that had no branding on it. We put on a musical in Edinburgh for Pot Noodle, which everybody thought was a gag, ludicrous, but it actually ran for a month or the duration.
But I
arrived there on the back of running a business, you know, with 20 people. I know how difficult it is to keep everybody sweet, and you're carrying a bunch of young people with mortgages and so on and rent. But I remember a few months in, there was one big, long, interminable meeting with a big client, actually, I think, who was paying quite a big fee. And it went on for like post 2 or 3 hours. And it became clear that we really weren't on the same page. And I remember they sacked the client. And I just thought that was the most impressive thing I'd ever seen. Because I was never in a position to do that. But also the fact that they said, well, look, we don't have the same objectives here. I think you should leave now. And I just thought that was punk, you know? But they genuinely, would pursue an idea, and they would, even if the client wanted a different idea, but if they felt it was the right idea, that's the idea they would make. They would sometimes, there was a trick where you would basically go back and you'd present something the week after it had been rejected the previous week. Because you still think it. And there were just things like that, which I thought was really great. And I just found it really impressive. The money did not always come first. Keeping the client did not always come first. And I think if you do, and also, you know, Adroga, Dave is great. Dave has a vision and he sticks to his guns and he's charming, but he's a maverick and he's a great creative. And they have great people there who Chris Watling is one of the best guys in town for making things happen, impossible things. So the real spirit of can-doism. And basically, both of those agencies feel like they're in control of the situation.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? Rather than, we're going to get sacked tomorrow kind of thing. Which, you know, just anxiety just leads to mass anxiety.
Yeah. And so what about the issue in that case of, just as agencies go in and out of fashion, certain agencies are spoken about in awed tones for a while, and then they sort of drift off, and one can think about in the past the BBHs of the world and Wieden Kennedys and Mothers and Hal Henry Chocolate Leary, all that lot, et cetera, and Droga 5. What about effectively the center of, the nucleus of creativity shifted? So, it used to be New York, London, taking in turns to be where it was all at, and occasionally then some other agencies would, pop up, individual agencies from other interesting places around the world. What about now, though? Is it a case that, quite frankly, it's a lot more exciting in, Shanghai and Melbourne than it is in London and New York or elsewhere?
I, to be honest with you, I don't know, because I was so not from advertising. I never went to the awards thing. I never read it. I just did. I'm not in on it. I know that if you go into agencies, there'll be loads of identikit creative teams, and they're all gushing over the latest spot from some obscure agency in Venezuela. I just never had a clue about that. I think the other thing is, a place, i.e. an office or a location, an area. That's kind of, for the next year anyway, is out the window because everything, of course, is predominantly remotely now. But it's true, you can build a vibe around a place. and, you know, you can have an exciting office and people want to be there. And it is a contact sport. And, you know, you can, great things happen when you put a whole bunch of disparate people together and they vibe off each other and come up with something really interesting. But I'm not in a position to say, because I just don't know. Is it Stockholm or Berlin or Lisbon? Or I really don't know.
Yeah. Okay, then, in that case, as we begin to sort of move towards the end of this, and it's been really, really interesting talking with you, Dermot. Thanks very much. What about, in the sort of short to medium term then, so what are you, what's coming up for you? I know you mentioned that the whole issue around Nederlander Studios in New York, but in terms of, you know, things that you are specifically working on or about to work on or looking forward to, etc.
I'd like to come back, Sean, and talk to you once we can talk about the music thing and also probably more about what we're trying to do in the US. But I think, you know, the kind of socio-economic issues are just kind of prevailing everything. You know, it's just, you know, things like risk. And, you know, we talked about work and the nature of work and even touch. I mean, it's just, I find it really scary that you're not, you know, this kind of new world we're going to emerge into and when it's going to be.
Yeah.
I'm not deliberately being evasive about your question.
No, not at all.
Maybe I am. which was about particular projects, because I'm just not in a position to announce yet.
Okay. What about then? Okay, so in terms of the overall sort of, if you say, sort of a positioning of these of this sort of podcast series, that, and I've had some like you, I mean, really, really interesting people who've kindly come along and sort of talked to me about what it is that they're up to and their viewpoints, etc. I mean, certainly what I've sort of hung the whole lot around is the areas of sort of hope, community, and resilience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know you mentioned, you know, a couple of the points about those as we've done this, but in terms of specifically, I mean, first of all, I mean, also in any particular order, in terms of hope, community, and resilience, I mean, I think that's what it's all really about at the moment. What are your views on it? I mean, feel free to completely disagree, but talk to me about that. Hope, community, and resilience.
Well, it's... it seems to me getting more parochial and kind of localism. Even you can see that even in government policy. I do think, again, without sounding very gloomy, I think all the optimism that we had in March, April, and everybody on Thursdays clapping carers, I think a lot of that's been pissed away. And that's, that's really a tragic mistake. And I think if everybody could do things differently, it'd be great to rewind to that moment, because there was something almost kind of naive about that, which I really liked. I mean, I wasn't really kind of joiner-inner in terms of that, but I just thought it was a very impressive initiative. And I think the way things have been so mishandled, if you ask people, for example, tonight to do a clap at 8 o'clock, I don't think very many people would show up. And I think that's a huge letdown.
Yeah.
And that's a missed opportunity. So how do we win back some of that kind of community good citizenship?
And
I don't mean just good citizenship on a kind of micro level, but also good citizenship from companies and brands. Which we started off talking about. But I really think that's the big missed opportunity. That kind of, you know, there was all this kind of weird folk art appearing in people's windows and you know, and people were like doing the Thursday thing and, you know, respect to care workers and frontline workers, and And then within months, they were being charged for car parking and surcharges if they were foreign nationals. And it's just...
Yeah.
How do we get some of that back? Is there a way to do that?
Mm.
Does that come from kind of local communities? It's got it, right? A friend of mine, a great writer and a great artist called Pete Kirby, who you might know, Sean, has created something called the Olive Network with the artist Roger Thorpe, and it's the first selfless social network. So it's basically the kind of the opposite of the kind of nastiness of Facebook. And it's very community-driven. It's a little bit like David Byrne's Reasons to be Cheerful.
Okay, yeah.
It's called ON, the Olive Network, the first selfless social network. And I think maybe we're going to have more of that kind of stuff where people are going to be plugging in locally and doing things collectively. And that might be a better answer to your question.
Hmm. That's fascinating. I'm looking actually, no lie, it looks absolutely amazing. And say, and obviously, I read a huge amount about, or a lot about, Facebook, the anti-social network, in my first book, Post Truth Business. And so, I'm no fan of the very odd Mr. Zuckerberg. But yeah, Olive Network looks absolutely great.
So maybe a whole network of things like that could be the start of something really interesting. And you know, the kind of the folk art thing, or the Thursday clap, or even going back to things like the Big Lunch, where there's kind of a cohesion again.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
You've also written about influencers, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, yes. My latest in Influencer Revolution was I did. More about sort of interesting people doing interesting things, as opposed to annoying sort of celebrities holding things and smiling at the camera.
Yeah. Well, maybe we've seen the back of the latter halfway iterate, you know, the maybe that could be another good thing that come out of this. I mean, I always thought an influencer was somebody who made something, who actually contributed to culture.
Completely,
you know, who was an artist or did a podcast or made t-shirts or had a band or did a all these people just inanely walking around taking pictures. And there's also, you know, talking about Temple and great rock and roll swindle, there's been the great advertising swindle, where all this money was siphoned from brands into these guys for the past kind of decade.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. I mean, someone should do a Cambridge Analytica on that.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Very good. Well then, Dermot, so as we begin to sort of finish off then, so just so the listeners know exactly where they can track you down, so go on then, where are you on that to their social media world, etc., and what's your site, etc., etc.?
I do have a website, as I suppose one has to if you're doing freelance stuff. Instagram, the usual suspects.
Okay.
Not hard to find, Sean. Easy to admire, hard
very
to find.
Good. Exactly. Well, look, that's been absolutely brilliant. So any other sort of final takeaway points you'd like to leave for the listeners around the world?
No, really. I mean, I just wanted to leave them with that and look up Colonel West, the justice, what love looks like when it goes out in public, because I think there's a clarion call, if ever we've heard one.
Wow!
So probably that.
Very good.
And can I just one final thing?
Yeah.
There's a great line from Seamus Heaney. It was never in a poem. It only appeared, I believe, in an interview he gave in 1972 with a newspaper. But it just seems such a kind of apposite line for these times. And you may have already seen it. Forgive me if you have, but for some of your listeners. And he said, if we winter this one out, we can summer anywhere. And it's probably a good way to finish.
That is absolutely fantastic. Whoa. Well, Dermot, that's been a really, really interesting conversation. Thank you so much. So Dermot McPartland, the maverick creative director and cultural connector, thank you very much indeed.
Sean, you are a gentleman and a scholar.
Excellent. Cheers, Dermot. Thanks.
Thanks, mate. See ya.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.